If you're, so who has taken complex analysis here? Oh, okay, good. All right, well, so if you're new to math club, I don't know, hopefully this doesn't scare you away. I actually forgot my notes this morning at home, and I hastily rewrote them, so that actually might make it a better talk, but I don't know. Okay, so I'm going to talk about elliptic functions. So what an elliptic function is a meromorphic function. So that means a function from C to C. And in case you don't remember, that is a function that's holomorphic or analytic, which means it has a complex derivative. It's a complex differentiable. So if you took complex analysis, you remember that you can, you know, if you have a function from C to C, you can just restrict to a real direction, restrict to an imaginary direction, take derivatives that way, and so if both derivatives agree that way, it's analytic, it's a complex differentiable. So a meromorphic function is a function that's holomorphic, complex differentiable, except at isolated singularities where you don't know what happens. So for example, a rational function, you know, all the zeros in the bottom, those are poles, but everywhere else it's good. So we want to, We have a meromorphic function, and something that we can do is we can ask what happens if we require it to be doubly periodic. So doubly periodic means that there exists two complex numbers with their ratio not being a real number, which means that they're not like along the same, well, yeah, I mean, think about that for a little bit. But such that f of z plus omega 1 is exactly the same as f of z. So if I just stopped there and just had one period, then it's just a normal periodic function that you can think of, and then you can do that. That's what Fourier theory comes from, just a simply periodic function. But a doubly periodic function is when you have two periods. And note that as soon as you have two periods, you have a lot of periodicity, because anything in the Z module, Z omega 1 directs some Z omega 2, basically that means everything N omega 1 plus M omega 2 with N and M integers is going to have, is going to behave in the same way. You're going to have the same functional equation. So, and this is called the period module. And so sometimes people refer to it as the periods. Those are the periods of F. Okay, so why do we care about these? What do we get? Well, I guess sort of let's think a little bit more about this period module. So if I have two complex numbers whose difference is in here, then F is the same on them. So if I'll say lambda is congruent to lambda prime, mod, and I'll call this M for module, mod M means that their difference is in M. And in that case, well, what we're saying here is that F of lambda equals F of lambda prime. So now what we can do is descend to the quotient by this, I mean, this defines an equivalence relation on all of C. So we can descend to the quotient C mod M. Well, actually, sorry, I'm going to choose a different letter. I'm going to choose L to be more suggestive. So this is pure module L, so I can mod out by L, mod out by this equivalence relation. And then, I don't know, so now I'll use the letter F tilde just to indicate it's a different object, but it defines a function on the quotient because it's well-defined modulo this equivalence. So I now have a function from C modulo L to C. But what is C modulo L? Well, L is a lattice, so I can think of it. So if this board is the complex plane, well, okay, I'll do a little smaller. If this board is the complex plane, here's 0. Let's say omega 1 is here, and omega 2 is over here. They're just points in the plane. Well, L is just all multiples of this one plus all multiples of that one, but integers. So 2 omega 1 is up here. 2 omega 2 is out here. etc. So it's going to just be a bunch of dots. There's negative omega 1, so it's lots of dots. And what does it mean? And then what does it mean to mod out by this? It means that, so we're, here's omega 1, here's omega 1 plus omega 2. It means that everything, so I'm going to draw a little parallelogram here. It means that everything outside of that parallelogram, well, I can, like, let's say I have something over here. Well, I can scoot it over by multiples of one of these guys and get it into this parallelogram. So everything outside of this parallelogram can be translated into it by adding integer multiples of omega 1 or omega 2. So I'll call this P sub 0. But the point is that when I mod C out by L, I have this fundamental domain. It's called fundamental domain. And each point in here, these points in here represent distinct elements of this this quotient. See, I, that's not a great explanation. So let's be a little bit careful about our boundary. So notice that all the points on this boundary are equivalent under this equivalence relation to something over here. So really when I mod out, I don't actually want to take both of them. I'll take that one and let's say the top one. Or no, let's just say the bottom one. And so if anyone's taken like some sort of algebraic topology, if you have like a square and you identify the top with the top and the side with the side, then that's the same as gluing it around, which makes a torus. So if you like thinking geometrically, this is the same as a donut. So, but whatever, that's not going to be important for this talk. But there's a torus, there's a complex torus. So really what we're talking about when we talk about double period is doubly periodic functions are functions from the torus to the complex numbers. Okay. And also another upshot of this is that when I want to think about, when I want to discover properties of F, all I have to do is pick my favorite parallelogram, translate of this parallelogram. I call this P0 because it's tied down at the origin, but I could have made it, I could pick any number A and do the same. This is A plus omega 1. Go this way, A plus omega 2. And just think about that parallelogram. And if I, let's say I've found, discovered some property of F that occurs in this parallelogram, well, I now have it, I now actually have a property of F altogether, because whatever happens in here is going to happen over here too, and over here, and here, and here, all other copies of this parallelogram. For example, I could make it, so suppose these guys, suppose here are poles of F, right, singularities. I could shift this around, suppose one landed on the boundary. Then I could shift my parallelogram of interest just a little bit, and make it so that I'm thinking about F restricted to P sub A. So that I don't have to worry about poles being on the boundary. For example, if I want to do complex integration. And that's exactly what we're going to do. But first, I want to point out that if there are no poles, so let's say I've had no poles in one of these fundamental parallelograms. None. So then it has no poles over here either. Or here, or here, or here, or here, or anywhere. Which means that it's a meromorphic function, but it has no poles anywhere in all of C. So if you've taken complex analysis, that means it's entire. It's holomorphic everywhere, which means that it's a constant. Okay, so that means that when we look for doubly periodic functions, if we discover that they have no poles in a parallelogram, they're constant and they're easy to deal with. Okay, so that's Liouville's theorem, if you remember that. And also, okay, so we want poles. But we only have to worry about finitely many, because only finitely many can occur here, because the fact that, remember when I said functions meromorphic means it has isolated singularities, well, isolated means they don't build up anywhere. And if they don't build up anywhere, you can only have finitely many of them fitting inside one parallelogram. So we only have finitely many poles to worry about, but a non-zero number of poles to worry about if we want to get our hands on these. And just a disclaimer, when I say the poles of F for the rest of this talk, I'm going to mean the poles in some fundamental parallelogram, not everywhere, because there are infinitely many everywhere. Okay, so the first theorem that I want to point out is that the sum of the residues of the poles in the fundamental parallelogram is zero. So and if you remember from complex analysis, a meromorphic function has a residue. A residue is what you can subtract from the function, or the R is a residue if F minus the number R over Z has an antiderivative. And so the sum of these residues has to equal zero. The residue theorem, the reason why residues, one of the reasons why residues are so useful is because the residue theorem tells us that the sum of the residues of a function, let's say at poles bi, see these are all the poles, bi of the function f, are equal to 1 over 2 pi I times the integral over around a contour that contains these poles. So for example, the boundary, here's a region that contains all our poles, so let's integrate around the boundary. All our poles are in here somewhere of f. That's the residue theorem. But this is zero, and that's easy to see, because what happens when we integrate around the boundary? Well, okay, we integrate along this, that's something. We integrate along that, that's something else. But when we integrate back this way, that's actually the same as integrating back along this contour. So really, we went out and then came back. Which means, but we came back in the opposite direction, so that picks up a negative sign. So this integral plus this integral is zero, and then this integral plus this integral is zero. So if you don't know what all that means, that's fine. It's just a theory of contour integration. But the point is that the symmetry, that f is the same on both sides, the sides in the top and bottom of the parallelogram, get us that enough symmetry to make this zero. Okay, well, what's the upshot of this? Okay. Probably not going to get to everything. Theorem is that there are as many poles as zeros counted with multiplicity. And that's so there are as many, F has so this is going to be nice, and this is the first theorem that we're really going to use. We're really going to put this to use. So, but later, in a little bit. So just a quick proof. I don't want to take too much time on this, but the simple poles of the logarithmic derivative, so if you take complex analysis or if you've taken it, you've probably seen f prime over f before, and this is a very handy tool. But the simple poles of this guy turn out to be are exactly the poles and zeros of F. With multiplicity, poles and zeros of F, and I can ask, what are the residues, so res of F prime over F for some simple pole, is exactly the multiplicity with a plus or a minus sign depending on whether it's a pole or zero of bi as a pole or zero of f. And okay, so to convince yourself of this, you should take out a piece of paper later. I mean, who am I kidding? But yeah. And just work out what this is, remembering that if f has like a zero, at A, then I could write f of z equals z minus A to the n f tilde of z. So I can basically, where this is non-zero at A, so I can basically pull out all the zeros. But do that a bunch of times and then do the logarithmic derivative and you'll see why that works. Right, so some of the residues is some of the, is the, okay, so now apply this theorem to f prime over f. So apply, now apply the previous theorem to f prime over f. By the way, f prime over f is doubly periodic, so I guess claim, well, we know f is doubly periodic, so claim f prime is doubly periodic. And, well, that's because, let's see, f prime of z plus omega I, omega 1 or omega 2, this works for. Well, that's the same as the derivative of, so this is the same as f prime of, so there's a new function that I can make called, I don't know, g of z, where g of z is f of z plus omega 1, but this is f, I mean, in disguise. But f, take the derivative of this, so g prime of z, well, the derivative of the outside, about, you know, chain rule, so, okay, good. But then, but g was just f, so this is actually still just, this is actually just f prime of z. Okay, right, so exercise again. So, great. So here's the crucial observation. Here's where we're going to use this later. So now f of z minus c, that has the same poles as f, for if I just subtract a constant. If f has a pole, then subtracting a constant is still going to be a pole. If f goes to infinity, subtracting a constant is still going to go to infinity. So this has the same poles as f, but f has as many poles as zeros in the fundamental parallelogram. So the number of zeros of this function is the same as the number of poles of f. Which shows that, well, zeros of this are where the function f attains the value c. So this shows that f attains a given value the same number of times. So f attains any value in C the same number of times in, I mean, just over the course of one parallelogram. So I say over the course of, meaning as Z varies over the parallelogram. All right. Later we're going to use... Okay, never mind. Moving right along. So, okay, so if we had doubly periodic functions, so this is what double periodicity gets us. We have this nice... We only have to look in parallelograms. We know these things about it, that it's going to attain values to the same number of times. And there's many poles of zeros and all this stuff. But do such things exist? I mean, we're talking about them. It's nice. But, like, how do I even know they exist? And so that's sort of what... So here was Weierstrass's approach to this. Weierstrass's approach. Well, what's the simplest one we could do? We can't have it have no poles, because then it's a constant. We can't have it have one pole, because there needs to be, poles need to come in pairs, because the sum of the residues has to equal zero. So if I have just one pole, with non-zero residue, then that doesn't work. So I need to have So the simplest example, if it exists, even, will have two poles, or two poles counted with multiplicity. So that means I have two choices. If I'm going to look in the simplest place, I can have one pole with order 2, or two poles with order 1, which are, in other words, two simple poles that are different. So why are stress picked this one? And in fact, this is a fruitful choice. It's a good choice. I mean, maybe he picked this one first and found out it didn't work. I don't know. I don't know if Weierstrass had this at the time, but there's something that we use now in complex analysis that's called partial fractions. And yes, it comes from the original, like, partial fractions from calculus, but it's a little more complicated. What partial fraction says, so it's actually something called the Mittag-Leffler theorem, but that's just fancy talk for partial fractions. What the theorem says is that if you have a meromorphic function in the complex plane, and it has poles, suppose it has some prescribed number of poles. So say F meromorphic with poles B, N, let's label them as with integers, such that the poles go off to infinity. Then the theorem says that F, okay, so when you have a meromorphic function, you have a pole. So let's say here's our pole, A. B17. And I don't know what's going on there. It's a little hole in my knowledge. This is an annulus. It doesn't look like an annulus, but everything outside of this point is an annulus. C minus point, that counts as an annulus. And whenever you have a function, so if I take a... Okay, there you go. That looks more like an annulus. So whenever you have a function that's analytic in an annulus, you can do something called a Laurent series. And so a Laurent series is an expansion as a power series, sort of like a Taylor series, but maybe you'll have negative powers. So f of z, so here, what would it look like? So we would have f of z in this disk around B17 would look like some negative powers with some coefficients, so like a negative n z minus B17 to the negative n plus a1z minus B17 to the negative 1 plus some, and then, well, okay, sorry, yeah, sum for the non-negative powers of anz minus b17 to the n, right? This is the typical Taylor expansion that we're used to seeing, but if I have a singularity, I have a Laurent expansion which gives you some finitely negative, many negative powers. So you might think that all we have to do to f is add up, and this is called the singular part of f at this pole, b17. So you might think that all we have to do to get f is up to make f an analytic function is subtract away all these singular parts. And in fact, that's basically true. I mean, it's as good as we could get. This is the sum. F is actually the sum, and I'll call this, let's say, p sub 17 of z minus b sub 17, right? It's just a polynomial in negative powers of this guy. All I have to do is sum over n of p sub n of z minus b sub n, and then I get an entire function. So this has no poles. The only problem is I don't know if this is going to converge. I don't know if this series is going to converge, but Mittag Leffler told us, actually, all you really need to do is little, okay, so this is a little p. All you need to do is take away, is adjust this each term by a little polynomial, and then you're guaranteed convergence for some little p. I'll say, sorry, little pn to make it converge. Okay, so that's really nice, but what's the upshot? How does this apply to our quest for an example of an elliptic function? Well, I know I'm looking for something with infinitely many poles. The poles, if I put them in some sort of sequence, they go off to infinity. And I can let the pole be at zero. I mean, I might as well take the fundamental parallelogram, the first fundamental parallelogram, to be this one and have my double pole be at zero. So really, I'm just looking at something. I want it to have an order 2 pole at each point of the lattice. Okay, and so this is telling me, first of all, what it's going to look like. So I guess the idea is, if a elliptic function were to exist, it's going to look like this. So let's postulate its existence. What are the singular parts going to be? Well, they don't have poles of order negative n. They have poles of order negative 2. So, and they're going to be at the lattice points. So I can, and it's going to have a pole of order 2 at 0. So the singular part from 0 is going to look like that. And the singular part from the rest, those are going to look like omega not equal to 0 from our lattice of, well, double pole means squared. This is going to be 0, and so that's going to create a double pole in our lattice up to an analytic function. But it turns out, and maybe with we have to add some polynomial here to make it converge, but it turns out that all we have to add is that, just a constant for each omega. So that's nice. And it also turns out that this g is 0. So we don't need to say up to an analytic function. We say that's good enough. So this is actually, and in fact, this is going to be our first example of some, okay, all this was to motivate where this Weierstrass P function comes from. This is going to be it. But, so we can write that down. And I guess I told you that it converges if we add this. So you'll have to believe me for now. So that converges. And it actually converges uniformly on compact subsets. So if you took complex analysis, you know that that makes it, well, in compact subsets of C except at the lattice points, which makes it, in fact, meromorphic and that sort of thing. But it also means that we can take the derivative term by term if we want. So let's see, what else do I want to say about this? So the fact, okay, right, so this converges. Okay, yeah, so that's the first major point of my talk, is that here we go. We actually have a viable candidate for a doubly periodic function, just based on poles, right? Just based on, like, well, where do I expect the poles of this thing to be? I can write down something that should be the simplest example of an elliptic function. There it is. Well, but how do I know it's doubly periodic? I don't. I just wrote down I wrote this down based on knowledge of what the poles should be. So that's the main question. And having written this down, you could spend a long time and probably do some computations to say it's doubly periodic by adding omega 1 and omega 2 to z. But there's an easier way to do it, and the way it's usually done in books is to take its derivative. And like I said, since it converges uniformly on compact subsets of this, you might remember from complex analysis that there's a theorem that says that you can take the derivative term by term in that situation. Okay. So, yeah, the key to proving double periodicity, which I'm going to do now, is the derivative. But first, I want to say that this is even. And I think we can just do this from sheer brain power, nothing fancy. Because suppose I replace z with negative z. Well, okay, so that's going to be the same, because it's squared. And replacing z with negative z here, well, that's going to be the, so, okay, let's just replace it, see what happens. So that's the same. So this is going to be the same as, since I'm squaring that, it's going to be the same as z plus omega squared. But I could, if I want, I could, I'm saying omega squared, but that's the same thing as negative omega parentheses squared. But notice that omega and L, so L equals negative L, because it's the lattice with the lattice stuff. So any omega, yeah. I think this is the best way to say it. So this sum is equal to the sum if I just replace all the omegas with negative omegas. So in fact, sheer brain power has now told us that. Okay. Right. So it's, we're good. F of negative z equals f of z. Check. Brain power. Okay. So now let's prove double periodicity. Here we go. F prime will converge. And so let's just do it term by term. So I'm going to have negative 2 over z cubed, right? Okay. Yeah, I just taught this all day. 408n. So now this is negative 2 over there. So what I get is, and I can, it's now okay to have a 0. So I can do, because I no longer have this, I no longer have this pesky 1 over omega in the way. So I now have negative 2 sum omega not equal to 0 of 1 over z minus omega parentheses cubed. So what were we trying to, what are we trying to prove here? We're trying to prove that F is doubly periodic. Well, okay, brain power again. F prime is doubly periodic. Because let's replace z. I want to show that f prime of z is f prime of z plus omega 1 or omega 2. Well, what happens in here when I replace z with z plus omega 1 or omega 2? I'm actually just moving the whole lattice by omega 1 or omega 2. But if, so L, so just the same way I wrote L equals negative L here, L equals omega 1 plus L, or omega 2 plus L. So, in fact, when I translate z, I'm still getting the same sum, the sum over the whole lattice. So, as soon as I got, so notice that as soon as I got rid of that pesky 1 over w squared, I became doubly periodic. Okay. So now, here we go. Why does, but we don't want this doubly periodic, we want f doubly periodic. Well, so now this implies that f of z plus omega 1 minus f of z, right? There's a perfectly good function for you. What's the derivative of this function? Well, the derivative of this function is has derivative. So this has derivative. What is that? Zero, because f prime is doubly periodic. So its derivative is identically zero. But so what, I mean, mean value theorem, when your derivative is identically zero, you're constant. So this is a constant. So is a constant. Okay, close. We're really close. We wanted to show that, we want to show f is doubly periodic, right? So we want this to be zero. All, so far we just have is a constant. Close. So we really just need to plug in one thing, and then we'll know what it is. Well, judicious choice, let's plug in, so plug omega 1 over 2. And, sorry, how about let's do negative omega 1 over 2 and negative omega 2 over 2. Then what do we get? Well, let's see, I'm going to move. Okay, I don't need that anymore. Move over here. What happens when I plug negative omega 1 into there? I have f of negative omega 1 over 2 plus omega 1, that's omega 1 over 2, minus, but when I plug in negative omega 1 over 2 there, f of negative omega 1 over 2. But what can you tell me about that? Remember, we're even. So this is equal to 0. And same with right. So I just did that. I can repeat that process with omega 2 replacing omega 1. And so it's in fact this is identically 0, right? So this tells me this is identically 0. There's my box. So in fact I have come up with an example of a doubly periodic meromorphic function. Okay. Great. All right, so in fact, so this is called the Weierstrass P function. So traditionally, that's denoted with a special typographical symbol. So what comes out of this process, if you're careful, and I haven't talked about any convergence issues, and they're interesting, but probably not for to see done on the board. So I've left them out. Sometimes the convergence issues are like the content, but not here. Although they're cool. So define this special typograph. So when you see a curly P, I think some people call it like pay. And this is with respect to the lattice that we started with, remember. Throughout all of this, L is a fixed lattice. There it is. And so you know how when you're looking for singly periodic functions, you come up with like sine and cosine? And then it turns out, if you're doing Fourier analysis, that when like all singly periodic functions are like combinations of sine and cosine, well, the same sort of thing happens here. But we don't even have two of them. We just have one. So it turns out that any doubly periodic function is a rational function in P and its derivative. And if I take the even elliptic functions, by the way, doubly periodic functions are called elliptic functions. If I take the even elliptic functions, those are rational functions of P. So that's cool. We just not only figured out the easiest example of all elliptic functions, but like all of them. Success. So I'm definitely not going to prove these things, but remark. Let's say the space E sub L, define that to be the space of doubly functions, meromorphic functions, doubly periodic with respect to the period lattice L, then, so this notation is, this is rational functions in P and its derivative, meaning, yeah, rational functions. So polynomials in those two things possibly divided by other polynomials. Okay. And denote EL plus by even such functions. Even doubly periodic functions, then EL plus is rational functions with coefficients in C of just P. Okay. But there's more. So we took the derivative, No, we didn't. Yeah, we did take the derivative, but I erased it. So P prime of z, just because we're going to use it, remember, it was negative 2 sum over omega and L, not even a 0 of 1 over z minus omega cubed. Okay, so we took the derivative. Now, what about an antiderivative? Well, notice, okay, so here's P, it's written over here, so I'll just talk for a second. So this has residue. Well, what's the residue of this? Remember, residue is what you have to subtract to make it have an antiderivative. But I can take an antiderivative term by term since this. Okay, hang on. So the only these are polynomials with a square. The only thing that could possibly prevent me from taking an antiderivative is if I had a 1 over z term in here, because then I'd have to do logarithms, and those might not exist. But the residue of this function is 0. And in fact, we could have required from the beginning that we're looking for a function with residue 0 of its double pole at the origin. In fact, the residue has to be 0, right? Because the sum of the residues is 0. And so, right. So the first thing I proved was that the sum of the residues is 0. I proved it right here. So in fact, of an elliptic function. So there's an elliptic function. It's residue 0. Oh, this is a square, right? This is 0. So it has an antiderivative. So what is it? Well, let's just try taking it term by term and see if it'll converge. It's traditionally denoted. So the antiderivative is denoted negative zeta of z. This is not the Riemann zeta. But keep in mind that there's this negative. So what will zeta be? Well, let's just try and take the antiderivative. Well, okay. I'm going to have, remember, getting rid of all our minus signs. And then, okay, I shouldn't just do algebra on the board. So yeah, okay. And then, what are the antiderivatives of these terms in here? Well, that first term there, I'm going to have 1 over z minus omega, keeping in mind that the minuses are getting absorbed right there. And then the antiderivative, remember from calculus, of a constant, I'll have, okay, I'm going to write it over here. I'll have 1 minus omega squared and then a z on top. Okay. But now, and okay, you may, so all my calculus students at this point would say, you forgot the plus c. Yeah, exactly. So plus c. So we have some freedom here. We're looking for an antiderivative. So let's be, maybe we should at this point, you know, before we get too deep, think about what a good c to pick would be. And in fact, we can pick a c to make it an odd function. So can we make it odd? And if we choose c to be 1 over omega, yes, then it's odd. So let's use our brain power again. Well, okay, so now if we replace z with negative z, we'll get a minus sign there. We'll get minus z minus omega, but then if we replace omega with negative omega, which we can do because L equals minus L, remember, that gets replaced with a negative, but that doesn't change, but z got a negative, so all the negative, so there will be uniform change of sign here. That hasn't, so in fact, zeta of z equals negative zeta of negative z. Check. So it's in fact odd if we do that normalization. Okay, so now, so here's how the rest of the talk is going to go. We have this antiderivative. What we can do is develop it in a Laurent expansion around the origin. So we can basically rewrite this as a power series in Z with some negative powers, and then differentiate that, and suddenly we'll have a Laurent expansion of P at the origin. And that'll be nice. And the coefficients of the Laurent expansion are going to be very important. And they're what's an example of what's called a modular form. So let's do it. Let's just see if we can. And sometimes in complex analysis, you can just use trickery. Actually, all the time. So maybe we can do a little trickery. So if you take 1 over z minus omega and do some, I guess, yeah, let's factor out negative 1 over omega from the bottom. And then we have some negative omega minus z. So then look, a geometric series, if z is small. So I have n greater than or equal to 0, negative omega out in front of 0 over omega to the n. So what I get now, but okay, so why did I do that? It's because here I have a 1 over, yeah, I have that. So what I'm going to get is a way to rewrite what's inside this bracket. So I have, I think I made a mistake. Let's see. So this is, well, I'm just taking this, but then I'm adding on. So I actually have negative starting with the 2. Yeah, sorry, I think this should be a minus. No. Okay, well, here's what I want it to be. Etc. Sorry. Yeah, okay. Sorry, I actually wanted a plus there. And then, okay, so maybe I wasn't really all that careful when I was using my brain power before. But this is it, and this is going to be odd. So I was wrong before, but now it's odd. So now what I get is, there we go. Yeah, because I moved them from that side to that side. Great. Okay. And that's, so I've now rewritten what's in this bracket as some powers of z. But now all zeta z is just summing over all of these for all of the omegas. So sum over all omegas, sum over L. And what am I left with? I'm left with zeta of z is 1 over z minus the sum from k equals 2 to infinity. So now I want to extract, I just want to do extract each coefficient of each power of z. So I'll have z to the k. What's going to be the coefficient? Well, if I sum, I'm summing over all of L, then each coefficient here is going to get all sum of the sum of, sorry, this should be a 3 and this should be a 4, right? Because I'm having, yeah, okay, 3 and 4. So 1 over omega to the k. And then this should be one power less. So omega and L. Okay, so that's my coefficient. And this, okay, I'm going to define this to be something. Well, okay. First, I want to go one step further. If I sum over all the omegas in L, and k is an odd power, remember L equals negative L. So that means if k is an odd power, I'm preserving the minus sign, right? Because I could do all, over all the positives and then over all the negatives. So, but then the minus sign comes out and they cancel. So this is actually 0 if k is odd. So this equals 0 if k is an odd number. So what I really have is, in disguise, sum over k equals 2 to infinity, and I just want to extract the odd powers. So I'll have sum omega in L 1 over omega. Sorry. Odd powers make it 0, so I want to extract. I'm just going to be left with the even powers. 2k. That gives me all the even numbers, but then I want this to be 1 less. So I have 2k minus 1. So, right, this is equals. Get that out of the way. So there we go. There's our answer. That's the Laurent expansion of the antiderivative. This has a special name. This is called G sub k. And so that's going to be, there it is. That's going to be our example of the modular form. I mean, sort of. Requires more explanation. Okay. So I'm going to keep going because it still hasn't been 50 minutes, right? Yeah. It's okay. It's not going to be a 2-hour talk, though. It's, all right. So, yeah, there's zeta. So what I'm going to do now is I'm just going to write down, expand out a few powers. In particular, the singular parts of all the things that we've got so far. Oh, sorry, one more thing. So there's our point. There's the Laurent expansion of zeta. So what's the Laurent expansion of P? Zeta prime, so negative zeta prime equals the wire stress P. So that means P of Z has, I just need to differentiate that Laurent expansion. And what I get when I do that, you can just work this out for yourself. By the way, I'm ignoring tons of convergence issues. But, well, not really. But from k equals 2 to infinity of k, and I was calling this g sub. Okay, some authors call this gk. Some of them call this g2k. I'm going to call it g2k, so I'm changing. So this is g2k z. So what do I get? The power rule. Okay, I can do the power rule. So I get 2k minus 1 comes down. g2k z to the 2k. But I want to start at k equals 1 now, right? Okay, let me just check that. No, it's just, yeah, I mean, no, just 2k minus 2. All right. So there it is. The Laurent expansion of P around the origin. And now let's just do a little playing around. Let's take the derivative of the Laurent expansion. So, well, okay, first I'll write out a few terms. So P of Z, 1 over Z squared, and 3 capital G sub 2, Z squared, plus 5 G3, Z to the 4th, etc. That's what P is. P prime of Z, just take the derivative term by term. The payoff is good. Just bear with me a little bit longer. Plus 20 g3 z cubed